Everything else is on the end of your fingertips. You know, I'm sure most of your listeners are listening to this on the go, on Spotify, on the phone. Why isn't rental? And our aim is, we realize, look, you can order an Uber in 3 clicks wherever you want to be. Why the heck can I not, in just 3 clicks, just same amount of clicks, rent a home? So we thought, let's centralize it all in one app and make it as easy as ordering an Uber.
Welcome to Tech Talks, hosted by myself, David Savage, and powered by Nash Squared. On today's show, I am joined by Harry Panter. He is the co-founder and CEO of Houser. And joining me to have a chat about that and a couple of other things, we've got Akish. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, good. It's Easter good. Monday that this is going out.
Yes, yes.
So hopefully you're having a nice weekend.
I shall hope so, yeah. I mean, I'm probably well-rested, well-relaxed, well-fed.
If you can't tell, we're recording before that eventuality.
But, yeah. So we're preempting how we're going to feel. But, similar moods to how we're feeling now, I guess.
Good. I did have a bit of a realisation, actually, yesterday. I felt really bad. I said, I'll have a great long weekend to some of our American colleagues. And they were like, long weekend? I didn't realise they don't get Good Friday and Easter Monday off. So apologies to our American listeners. You're actually our biggest audience. You've had to put up with us going on about the Easter holidays for the last couple of episodes, and I didn't realise until yesterday that you don't have them. So sorry about that. We hope you have a lovely weekend nonetheless. But this is a work day for you, and we hope it's going well.
We do. But we also don't get Thanksgiving, so...
Yeah, that's true. And I was trying to be sincere. I don't think it's... sincere.
We're equal.
There we go.
Exactly.
Akish, did you rent much when you moved to London? I kind of get the impression that maybe you didn't.
I did, yeah.
Oh, you did?
No, I did, yeah, for a little bit.
Was it a pain in the arse?
Paying the rent, yeah, obviously. Parting from money. But, I mean, it was in the job that we do.
Yeah.
Being in sales, obviously, month to month, sometimes our income can vary. You know, and I found it a bit of a pain in the ass when you try to explain kind of what you can earn and what you afford and that sort of thing, right? I found that to be a bit of a pain in the ass and all the kind of admin-y stuff around it.
I had to move a couple of times in quick succession in a number of years, and I fell foul of not keeping on top of which energy provider was at which property and having and found out that I'd been paying the wrong energy provider for 12 months until I got a bill from the proper one. And had to go to the one that I've been paying and go, why haven't you told me that I'm massively overpaid, that they did pay the money back? And then I was able to, like...
Honestly.
So, in that situation, Houser would have been really, really useful. Without any further ado, we'll hand over to the interview, you'll find out what we're on about, and we'll come back afterwards. Today, I'm joined by Harry. Harry, you are the co-founder and CEO of Houser. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Oh, sorry, I should say my Houser. Houser is the bit in bold, but my Houser or just Houser? How would you say it?
Long story short, it's a bit of both. The UK brand is Houser and the US brand is my Houser. Look, there's debates in my marketing team to merge them both together.
I bet.
We'll see what happens in the next 6 months. And maybe if you have me on again, I'll be able to announce what our actual new brand looks like.
Just out of interest, why is that? Because surely it... It's not by design, right? I mean, I'm assuming there's some other player in the market or something, or
no, not at all. So we're across the UK and the US. I'm sure we'll go into what our product actually is, but we're based around students, and in the UK, it's you can drink from 18, right? Where in the US, it's dry campus, and a lot of our marketing was towards download the app, here's a free beer, this sort of guerrilla tactic. We had to switch to more of a global tech platform that's got a lot of credence because housing is all about trust in the US. So we actually changed our brand for the US, but at the same time, it leans into a non-student market you want to go into. Like my bills, my life, my Houser, my college, my community, my life, my Houser, everything surrounding the home that we have access to. So a bit of changing because of the culture in the US, but also changing ready for scalability in the future.
Well, look, that kind of alludes to the audience about the kind of the topic area that we're talking about today. But tell us a little bit then about what my Houser is all about.
Yeah, sure. So me and my co-founder started this at university about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. We've been live for 2 years full time on this. And it basically solved a problem that we were having ourselves. The market was so decentralized. One app here, one phone call here, one email over here. And we thought everything else is on the end of your fingertips. You know, I'm sure most of your listeners are listening to this on the go, on Spotify, on the phone. Why isn't rental? And our aim is, we realized, look, you can order an Uber in three clicks wherever you want to be. Why the heck can I not, in just three clicks, just same amount of clicks, rent a home? So we thought, let's centralize it all in one app and make it as easy as ordering an Uber. So all of a sudden, on our app now, you can find flatmates, find a home, manage that home, everything from search to utilities, all in one place. And you can also get paid to pay your rent. So by interacting with the mobile app, by answering certain questions, you can earn money on the app. So instead of £500 a month, Dave, this month, your rent is actually 20 questions that these big brand partners ask you. So we're trying to not just pioneer change in the rental market, but solve the affordability crisis that students are facing at the moment and have been facing for a very long time. We realized, Dave, that, you know, as we were building this, the problem's just as big for property operators, so for letting agents and landlords. So we created an end-to-end platform, a mobile app for students and a web portal for letting agents and landlords that lets them automatically manage their homes and automates a lot of their workflows so they can better advertise and manage their tenants and properties. And then it's the same sort of principle. So our customers over here are letting agents to students in the US, similar principle, but our customers are actually the universities. So we actually charge universities there and are their official housing partner. It's been a pretty big journey, just two of us now, 35, and across the States. So it's pretty cool, but that's kind of housed in a nutshell.
So look, I mean, you say there that you started it 4 years ago when the two of you were students. What was the initial sticking point? Because it sounds like there's added complexity along the way, but what was the initial sticking point that made you go?
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong. Like the going back to our first drawing of the app to now, it's completely different. And I'm sure we'll look back at this in 2 years and it'll be even a different landscape again. The core principle of Houser is it was hard to find a property at university. It was overwhelming. All the different ways to find a house were all over the market and not accessible. And there was no advice from the university or the market itself. So we thought, how do we match us as students with a property with minimal effort? All I need to do is focus on my exams and honestly going out and having a good time and enjoying university. I don't want to have the stress of finding a home. And look, Dave, the market expects these 18-year-olds who 4 years ago were just starting secondary school, right, to all of a sudden navigate the private rental market. Now, for me or you, you know, the private rental market is a scary place, let alone someone also who's 18 but also coming from a different country. So we thought, let's do something to first solve our problem, solve our friend's problem, their friend's problem, and all of a sudden we have a user base. So the initial sticking point was to solve that clear matching problem from students to properties, and it's just expanded and evolved since then.
And when you say expanded and evolved, has it been an expansion? You know, the grey hairs give away the fact that I am old enough that I was at university when Facebook first launched, and Facebook very much spread like wildfire amongst student communities, and then after a point, spread out into the general population. How are you thinking about scaling the business? Is it a case of, here's one university town where we can fix student problems, now let's go to another university town, another university town, another university town, and then perhaps those users will carry you through into post-university life?
Yeah, so definitely. So what you're talking about is like a network effect, creating it so it's reaching critical mass in one city first and being that organically driven that it drifts into other cities. Then you go there and capture that demand as it's drifting there. So when you capture it, those users are way more engaged. So I totally agree that's an option we're looking at. But our main point of call with expansion is going city by city, but also through our perks page. So our perks page has localized brand partners across the whole country. So we work with the Papa John's, we work with different energy companies and alcohol brands. So they're our expansion plan. But first and foremost, we're in Manchester and Birmingham and trying to reach critical mass there. And they're going to four more cities this year across the country. But one of our big indicators is not actually from students, it's from the rental market itself. So we're going to be expanding to cities where it's the hardest to rent a home for these letting agents. So how hard was it to rent your home, Dave, as a letting agent in Birmingham? Oh, it was extremely hard because of these variables. And I might be a letting agent myself and say, actually, in Manchester, it was quite easy. So our target market would be you, Dave, because we're an alternative platform to what they're currently using versus Rightmove and Zoopla, etc. So my strategy, to be honest with you, is all about de-riskification. because we haven't got the big budgets of like right moves. So I need to make sure that my expansion is completely riskified. So I first take it off the rental behaviors from the letting agent and then look at my organic growth with students. But on that note, I'm sure most of your listeners have heard of Calendly. And if you've not had Calendly before, where you schedule your own meetings in someone's diary, if you've not got it or signed up, you schedule a meeting, it will ask you to create an account to view that meeting. Now, that's organic growth. Similar principle I try to take into Hauser, whereby you sign up as a cohort of students. So say we live with each other, Dave, me and you both sign up together, right? So therefore, I acquire myself as a user for different ads or acquisitions, and I get four more on average. So for every one acquisition, I get four extra ones for free. So that's how we've managed to grow so quickly as well.
Talk me through this concept of getting paid for answering questions. You kind of mentioned it in the intro, and
I'll have to create you an account.
I'll park it for a second. But let's go back to it because it's an interesting concept. But I'm assuming, you know, there is that explicit exchange that if you're answering questions, you're basically giving away a bit of data, a bit of marketing data in return for some monetary value. How have you kind of worked that out and also made sure that people are kind of comfortable with what they're giving? Because it can't be for free, right?
Exactly. Look, so we hold thousands of data points per user with our utility, because obviously we sell and buy and sell energy and do utilities and split the bills to these students as well. A lot of our properties have smart meters. So, for example, Dave, I know on average when you have dinner, your oven goes on, your lights go on, right? So I know that you have dinner about 5 p.m. So at 4:40, maybe 20 minutes before, I will push a Domino's notification through my app on the community part of the app to you saying, hey, Dave, let's get a takeaway tonight instead of cooking, just before you're about to cook on average. So Domino's will pay me to basically put that. And look, I'm not got a partnership. I'll put a disclaimer. I am not working with Domino's, but it's an example. I should probably say my actual partner, which is Papa John's. Sorry, Papa John's. Papa John's will pay me to basically access that data and push that notification at a certain time, given the insights that we have. But you're totally right. The student has to be comfortable. Dave, we've been on this call for maybe 15, 20 minutes now, and every 15 minutes, your data is sold over 1,000 times across different platforms from Google. You put on you fill out some insurance document, you put in your salary, you're going to get targeted now for certain disposable income products, right? So we have all this data that's been sold. Why are we not making any money from it? And it's the same with students. Students are going through a massive crisis where they can't afford rent. So what we say is, look, we're going to interact with you. We've got data points on you. Now, let us use your data. And by letting us use your data, we'll give you a bit of the revenue that we're making from monetizing your data, right? So we're one of the only platforms actually doing this. So that little exchange of me sending you a Domino's notification just before, Domino's make money from you buying a pizza. We make money from the brand actually paying us to access that data. And we give back a portion of that back to you.
So you're taking the ad tech business effectively and going, hey, look, you know this happens, why not make it work for you at the same time?
Because they become way more engaged, and the more engaged they are, the more valuable my data is. The more valuable my data is, the higher premiums I can sell them for. The more I can sell them for, the more I can give the student money back. So all of a sudden, Dave, I have a nearly free marketplace in the long-term future for rental markets. But in the short term, I've become the cheapest student rental market player in the industry, because I am given a route to offsetting their rent. So that's one B2B aspect of it. The second thing, Dave, is if these big clients are spending millions of pounds on pay-per-click, instead of spending that, they come to us with a set of questions. Dave, you're on my app, you get an education. What's your favorite cocktail for 50p? You know, where are you going tonight on a night out for a pound? You know, do you go out in groups, or do you like going out on your own for £2? That money goes into a Hauser wallet. That Hauser wallet directly pays your rent to the landlord. So you're offsetting your rent by answering questions and interacting with my app. And then that data comes back to me, and I sell it back to the operator. And without rambling on too much, we have a third stage to this, Dave, where we've got the student involved there. We've got the brand partner involved, and we're involved. So we're all making money. We're happy, fantastic. Mm-hmm. We're awesome customer experience. But what about the letting agent who represents the property that your student's in? What we say is letting agents right now make money on one day a month when the rent comes in for management fees. Why not monetize the other 30 days in that month with these tenants being sat there? So we also give a portion of that income to the agents or landlords as well.
When the information came through on your business from PR to say, hey, why don't you interview Harry? On the surface of it, you kind of go, prop tech. And then you listen to your talk and you go, oh, maybe it's energy and utilities. And then you kind of go, oh, there's a bit of ad tech in there as well. And you talked before about, you know, taking on incumbents. You name check Zoopla and Rightmove. Is that problematic if it's difficult to pigeonhole you, or is it a benefit? I mean, from an investor point of view, they might look at your business and go, "Well, what am I investing in here? What exactly are you?"
The beauty of it is, Dave, is look. In essence, we want to be the future of rental. We want to be the go-to platform, like UCAS is for students applying to university, for students to find a house off campus. That's the core principle of Houser. And we are prop tech and fintech in the basis of we are a property platform that has financial institutional features. For example, being able to split the bill payments and offer utilities. But that's the tip of the iceberg. Once you are on my app, I'm able to monetize you and reward you for monetizing you in different ways. The reason why I believe we're going to be a billion-pound company isn't from being the future of rental or helping someone solve a utilities problem or even solving the affordability crisis by giving students a route to offset their rent. It's actually from the data part of the business, right? It's from the data part of the business that we, because at the end of the day, Dave, your home is so important to you. So as we've realized, we've created a product that controls one of the most important epicenters of your life, your home. Hence the rebrand to My Houser. My finances, my life, my Houser, everything is around your house, your Houser. So we believe that by having the home at the center of your person, it gives us access to monetize wider things of one's life. For example, their college experience, their community, where they go for drink, where they eat, you know, what the behaviors they have when they put their heating on or not, you know, or what they drive, Ubers, train line integrations, you know, brand partners. That's the wider economy we've created around one's home and then therefore around one's house. So we're prop tech and fintech, but mainly prop tech with a bit of fintech because utilities. But long term, our big play to get to that unicorn stage is data. I hope that answers your question, if hopefully directly. It can seem a bit of waffle sometimes, but in essence, we're prop tech.
You mentioned, I think, that it was the two of you, now it's 35 of you. Two of you in your bedroom or in your student dorm, now 35 and kind of multinational. Is that right?
Yeah, it was actually me and Ben at university in a laundry room. It was the only place that had a whiteboard on. It was the only place that had a whiteboard on in halls of residence. So we mapped it out there, and then there's 30 of us in the UK and then five of us in the US. We just opened an office up in the US with our president who's leading it there.
To go from students with an idea and enthusiasm and a business idea to where you are today, not only has the business evolved, but I imagine you've evolved. What do you think you have noticed the biggest change in how you are leading from the first 3 to 6 months to where you are today?
Yeah, well, better to maybe ask my team that and see if I'm any good. I think the biggest thing that's changed for me is my focus is on the business. I think when you first start, it's all about how the hell do I fund this damn thing? Like, how do I get this off the ground? And then once it's off the ground, it's like, okay, well, how do I actually make it into a business? And then once it's actually into a business, how do I actually grow this? And through every stage, you grow massively. I'm 23, my co-founder is 25. You have to grow up quick. Like, you're speaking to people. The people don't care about age, especially in the US. It doesn't matter if you're young. You have to grow up quick. But I think the biggest thing that's changed for me is, at the start, I took every bit of advice from everybody. Now, if I was to give one bit of advice to anybody, it would be getting advice, right? However, at the start, I took blanket information from everyone. And I've now turned into I like to call it a strategic sponge, right? I'm a strategic sponge where I only let certain information in. Because, you know, you want firefighters in your business who have experienced and done what you're doing or trying to do. So I have an advisory panel of 14 who have all invested, awesome individuals, and investment is a part of that to make sure that advice is not dangerous. And they are finance experts, legal experts, prop tech experts, utilities, data, and they are giving me the advice. And I try and listen to those people only. So I think at the start, I was like, come on, give me that advice, everyone. And as I've got a little bit older and more experienced, I've turned that into strategic advice and only taken on certain people's advice. But also, the biggest difference in the overall business, Dave, has been the pace of iteration. I believe if you are proud of the product you put to market at first, you've done something wrong. I think you need to go to market as soon as you possibly can, get market feedback and iterate. That's one thing. And at the start, we realize that at the very start. And then as we've got more experience, we've changed that from iteration to the key metric and thing we're looking at is rate of iteration. How quickly, if you're a client of mine, you give me feedback and I iterate that, update that, and send you back an updated product. And that allows us to have constant product market fit. And that's why we've grown so quickly, because our product is in demand, because we are iterating based on feedback very, very quickly, and quicker than our competitors. So that's what's changed, the pace of iteration and probably strategic advisors rather than blanket advice.
You mentioned that you are confident you'll become a unicorn. With that comes lots of different pressures. And I imagine that the pressures that you faced when you were whiteboarding in the laundry room are very different to when other people's money is invested in your business. How are you coping with that?
Sometimes I think I'm not. I think any founder that comes on here, excuse my French, it would probably say the bullshit. Like, if they do, I think the biggest thing for me is that I do believe we can be a £1 billion company, but I would never sit here and tell you we are going to be. What I will sit here and say is we've got the capacity to get there as long as we hit our growth metrics, and we've hit everyone since. I think the pressures now and how I handle them are just keep making sure I've got time for myself. You know, my diary is 7 till probably 6, and then my US diary is probably 8 till maybe midnight. And that might seem very unsustainable, but there's gaps in there. You know, having a team, delegating. When you get a bit bigger, make sure you are delegating properly, but delegate with visibility. I've stripped back the hierarchy in the business, give everyone fluidity in terms of their tasks, making sure everyone is visible in terms of what each team is working on so they can make decisions themselves. I'm not a bottleneck, because as we're getting bigger, if I'm a bottleneck, I have to get involved. If I have to get involved, Dave, my diary goes to 3 a.m. So then it's not sustainable. So it's delegation and keeping everyone visible on what everyone's working on to not be a bottleneck myself. And then keeping time for myself, going to the gym, keeping fit, keeping healthy. You know, how can one be alert if they're sluggish and not in good shape, for example? And I'm a big advocate on that. And I know in this culture, it's not probably the best thing to say, but I do think you need to be in the best possible shape to do great things. You need to be great in everything you do, not just the work you're doing. So it's a bit of a mixture of focusing on myself, block booking time, being strict on my diary, and empowering all my team to make decisions without me.
And you said you're a sponge for information. What founders or entrepreneurs do you look up to? You must have one or two kind of, maybe not idols, but people that you certainly respect.
Yeah, look, I'm probably controversial as this guy as well. Like Elon Musk, he's obviously awesome. I have an innate fascination for space, and I really do one day. My whole purpose of doing this is not to be a billionaire, just be a billionaire's sake, but I believe to make a difference in this world, you've got to have a level of cash to have the level of influence. And I would then be able to like advance us as a human race, you know, invest into health tech, space tech, and ed tech. And no one should be hungry, no one should be homeless and stuff, you know. So probably Elon Musk and what he's doing.
Okay, so look, if you had the opportunity to ask Elon Musk a question that you think would help your career development and your leadership, what would it be?
Right now, the knowledge you have is limited. The knowledge you don't have is unlimited. How do you switch that around? He seems to know everything about everything. How do you make sure, how do you attain that information so quickly? Because at the end of the day, the knowledge you have is limited. So how going back to that sponge idea you said before, how do I make that more efficient? Because I'm working every day, all day, and don't get much time to learn. So the time I do, how do I make that way more efficient and switch that around to unlimited knowledge?
Well, look, there might be some students listening to this, but equally, I would wager that some of our audience are private landlords. If someone wants to find out more about the services you're offering, what's the best way?
Yeah, look, honestly, because I'm on this podcast, they can drop me a personal email. And if you've got anybody, you can pass on my number as well. But the main thing is head to our website and on there you can book in a call with our sales team. They're absolutely awesome. He can talk your ear off and tell you all about what we're doing. But if you want to drop me an email, I can send something over as well. And we've currently got our raise open as well. So invest in the future of rental, Dave, maybe yourself or people you know. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks.
Okay, so one of the things that Harry talks about in there is getting paid by brands for answering questions. I really like this idea that if you're living in a flat and you've got information, if you give brands a bit of information about you, it might lead to money off your rent. I kind of wish that when I lived about four doors up from the Shaftesbury Tavern on Hornsey Road, that had been the case with them. But I really like this idea that your data can work for you and help you pay towards kind of utility bills.
Yeah, you can use it to your own advantage, right? And when we talk about the cost of living and the prices and energy bills and rent and you know, all that sort of stuff going up. Our data is ours, and it's free for us to use however we want to use, right? We all, I don't know how many times a day we accept or decline kind of our data being used for, whether it's location data, date of birth, you know, what we do for a living, what pages we view on the internet and all that sort of stuff. If we can get some ROI on it, then yeah,
happy
absolutely.
Days,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Harry, we wish you the best when it comes to expansion in the US. I think it'll go very well. But for now, we're going to change topic very quickly. Akish, not only are you co-host of this podcast, you are an FT correspondent. Well, not a correspondent.
Oh, God, here we
You're
go.
You're a Financial Times analyst, let's say that. I saw on my Instagram, folks, this morning that Akish has contributed to an article in the Financial Times, very highbrow, Financial Services Counting on AI for a Productivity Boost.
Yeah, exactly. I've you know, I've been stopped a few times on my way to work this morning on the train.
Well, there is a big picture of you.
There is a very power photo.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Arms folded, you know,
square.
Jacket. Yeah, you know. I've been that photo's been doing the rounds of my friends' WhatsApp groups for the last few days. With all kinds of profanity and stuff written around it. But anyway, no, it's great and I was asked to contribute to, I guess, quite a matter which, you know, the only way I can describe it is financial services, number one, trying to deal or trying to work alongside AI with caution, and B, financial services firms almost a bit, threatened with what AI could do. In the simplest of terms, obviously at the moment, from a trading perspective, or how most, let's say, investment banks make money, is through humans. You know, we have human traders, and traders trade any kind of product, from your commodities to FX to equities, whatever. And the decision making behind that is not that one trader's sole responsibility. It's about 2-3 mathematicians, a quant person, a software engineer, and, you know, those database decisions are being made quite quickly. But, you know, people that I've spoken to in banks, they've said, look, the minute there is a, you know, AI tool or an AI, you know, bot to replace a trader, and those decisions can be made in milliseconds rather than minutes, obviously that will have a huge impact on the market and sort of, you know, revenue generation and things like that. But also, you know, that's maybe what you could say a threat to, you know, human productivity. But I guess, you know, the other side of it is, you know, how many more things could banks help with in terms of, you know, going out to new markets, you know, not actually having a physical presence in, let's say, a LATAM market or a Middle Eastern market, but, you know, are able to use AI to their benefit and grow.
I don't see it as a threat to productivity. I see it as
some people do.
It's a threat to some people's jobs, absolutely.
If people
aren't being invested in by the organisations that work for them. There are new jobs being created. You talk about that in this article.
And
it's incumbent. A couple of days ago, we were talking about the fact that Utah have passed a new piece of legislation around AI. The quote that was used was, "With great power comes great responsibility." And it's true, because a lot of these firms have a huge amount of power being unlocked due to AI. They have responsibility, and part of that responsibility is not just to not deceive consumers, which is what the Utah policy is about, but it's also to invest in staff and to make sure that they take these people on a journey with them and don't just throw them by the wayside if they don't have the skills.
And I think when you mention productivity, right, it allows people that banks are paying quite a lot of money for on a yearly basis to do their job a bit better, and also in the article, you know, mundane tasks that they have to get involved with, they are able to leave that to AI, you know. So, for example, you know, things like AI can be used in anything, right? Like from producing slide decks and flash reports and, you know, kind of stuff like that, all the way to executing a trade. So, you know, if we get the sort of bankers of, let's say, London, who do have to, you know, write reports and write kind of market trend forecasts and, you know, produce PowerPoint and decks and things like that. If all that bulk of work, which is about an hour and a half to 2 hours a day or every other day of a front office banker, if they leave that to AI, think about how much more effective they can be, you know, to get their own insights on the market and sort of, you know, where best to, yeah, hedge their bets, so to speak. But yeah, no, it's cool. And thanks a lot to Nash Squared as well. I have to say that because they gave myself and Pete Weston, a colleague of mine in my team as well, allowed us to share our thoughts. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, there you go. If you want a bit of extra reading, we'll put a link in the show notes to that. One job, though, that some of those people who might worry about losing their jobs won't be able to necessarily go into. I've also read this morning, apparently scientists are turning to AI to make beer taste even better as well.
Ooh,
is there no end?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm all up for that. And non-alcoholic beer.
No. So they collected samples and with 16 participants sampled and scored 250 beers for 50 different attributes. That would have been a very fun and messy job.
Yeah.
16 people, 250 beers. After two pints, I wouldn't know what 50 different... I mean, 50 different attributes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
But it tastes quite nice, yeah.
Yeah, it all tastes the same after about 3-4. But, you know. anyway, yeah. But also, you'd have to make sure that you are, you know, obviously alert and conscious and, you know,
which is always the case when you're drinking 250 beers.
250 beers, yeah, exactly.
Anyway, look, we hope that you're having a good Easter, whether you're able to take some time off or not, or for that matter, just having a good week, and we will be back on Wednesday. Tech Talks is hosted and edited by David Savage. It is produced by Nash Squared. And we have special thanks to Lemzy for supplying music to this show.